The hour is upon us. Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon, members of the public and Lahontan staff. Welcome to the regular meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board, Lahontan Region. My name is Kimberly Cox from Hellendale, and I am the board chair. I want to thank the public for attending today. Your comments, ideas, and participation are vital to our decision-making process. And we do a better job when you give us your input. At this time, I'd like to introduce the other members of the board. To my right, we have Keith Dias from Rosamond, Dr. Amy Horn from Truckee, Don Jardine from Markleyville, and Peter Pumphrey from Bishop. Our board member, Eric Sandell from Truckee, was unable to be with us today. Our executive officer is Patty Kumyunjin. Ms. Kumyunjin, would you please introduce your staff?
I'd be happy to. To my left is Kim Niemeyer, our staff counsel, and Sue Genera next to her. In the audience, we have Anna Catherine Bennett from the State Board, Gita Kapai, also from our State Board, to join us, Lori Kemper, our assistant executive officer. We have Doug Smith, one of our division managers from Tahoe, and I have Mike Plasiak, one of our other division managers from the Victorville area, Rich Booth from Tahoe, Ann Holden from our Tahoe office, Lisa Dernbeck from our Tahoe office, and those are our staff. Thank you.
Thank you. The regional board has three items on its meeting agenda today and many more items for tomorrow. For this afternoon, the first item is a public workshop on the draft order for PG&E's chromium contamination in Hinkley. Later this evening, we will resume with a second item, a status report on the related activities in Hinkley, and the third item is a public forum. The goal of the public workshop is to provide clarification and understanding of significant changes that have been made to the most recent draft of the cleanup and abatement order. This draft was released by the Water Board's advisory team on September 1st. The release of the draft order began the 30-day comment period, which ends on September 30th. We encourage your written comments to be submitted in writing by that date. The format of workshop today will involve several panels during which proposed significant changes to the order will be explained. Those explanations will be followed by a facilitated question and answer period. The public's input is important to us so we can draft a final order that requires cleanup as quickly as possible while ensuring that any potential impacts from the remediation are reduced to maximum extent practicable, and that the community is protected. No decisions will be made today on the draft CAO. After the comment period closes on September 30th, the board's advisory team will review the comments, propose any additional changes, and respond to the comments received. The Water Board has tentatively scheduled November 4 and 5 to hold a public meeting to consider adoption of the final order. If you have any questions about the process today, please don't hesitate to ask. You can speak to any of our staff members that will help you understand the process. It can be a little daunting, and we want to make sure that all of you understand how this will work. During the workshop, we will have the board members join you in the audience so that we can all participate in hearing what is to be shared with us today. At this time, I'd like to ask board member Peter Pumphrey to share some opening comments.
Thank you. I really don't have much to say except to say thank you again for taking the time to be with us today and to be part of this process. As I think we explained in May and will probably explain again today, this is not the normal way that these orders necessarily come into existence. Oftentimes people go and they craft an order and they come and say, here it is, here's what we're proposing to do. But we really wanted to try to have as much participation from all of the people involved in what's going to be the ultimate decision, or all of the people involved in the situation, to try and craft something that we could feel comfortable would meet everyone's needs as much as possible. And I for one, am very, very grateful for all of you who have come and helped, I think, us see that was a good decision. I think one of the things that you'll see today is that there was a lot of progress made as a result of the conversations that took place in May, and that that progress really demonstrates, one, that we're getting a better order potentially, and two, that there's a lot of value in the idea of bringing people together and having them work together to try and find solutions to issues. There are still things that are going to have to be worked out. There are still decisions that are going to have to be made. But because of your effort and because of your enthusiasm and because of your willingness to take time from your lives to help us, I think that we're going to come up with a better product than we might have if we pursued another path. So again, thank you for your time today. Thank you for all of the time that you've put in trying to give us input and information that hopefully will lead us to make an informed and workable decision. Thank you so much.
I'd like to just make a logistical announcement before I introduce Gita, and that is for the ladies, they're doing renovations in this hotel, and for the ladies, the restroom facilities are available outside by the ice machine area, and you just won't have a mirror. For the gentlemen, I'm sorry, the facilities are still under construction, and if you could go to the front desk and get a key, they'll allow you to use some other alternative facilities. So with that, I was going to introduce Gita Kapai, who's going to help facilitate the session for us this afternoon and this evening, and she's going to lay out some of the ground rules and give you some guidance on how to go forward on the workshop. And with that, those of us up here will be moving to the audience.
So before we begin, in the opening comments, the chair mentioned that there's an advisory team and a prosecution team, and I'm just going to turn it over to our legal counsel to explain what that is and have the folks that are on the various teams raise their hands so that you can see who's in what position. So, Kim?
Hi. So we have something that comes out of due process ideas, which is fairness, so you want a hearing to be fair. And it also comes out of case law from the California Supreme Court, that when we're hearing an item such as this where someone has rights that may be affected, we divide into two groups, the water board does. And one group is an advocate for their position. So the prosecution team put out a draft cleanup and abatement order, and they're advocating for the positions in that order. The advisory team, which, I'm sorry, first let's identify the prosecution team. The prosecution team is Ann Holden and Lisa Dernbach and Lori Kemper, and Anna Catherine Benedict is counsel for that group. And so they're advocating for those positions. In order for the board to make a decision that's fair, they need to be able to hear all sides of that information, all sides of that issue. And so the advisory team, which is made up of Patty Kuyumjin and Doug Smith and Rich Booth and myself, we provide the board with that advice. So we take the information that we hear from the prosecution team, from PG&E, from the community, from all the different various groups, and we synthesize that for the board and we provide them advice. So we try to make it so that it's neutral and fair. And so when you hear prosecution team and advisory team, that's what's going on. And just so that you know and understand, too, we don't talk to each other in the office about this matter. We try and make it very transparent. So those conversations that we have, we also share with you. So I hope that sort of makes that clear. Does anyone have any questions about how that works?
All right. Okay. So I don't. This is an awkward room, and I don't know where to stand. So if I stand over here, and you all look this way, but can you hear me? So
you're in the dark.
Yeah. So I'll stand here, and I'll try and project, and then
be able to hear you now.
Okay. I need to be close to you.
Thank you.
Okay. So. Some of you were here back in at the end of May. We kind of shook things up a little bit. We had a meeting where I broke everyone up into groups, and we had conversations. And as a result of that, there were more conversations that happened, and then there were some consensus items that occurred. And so here today we're going to be going over the two positions. We're going to clarify the ideas for consensus. We're not here to debate these opinions. We're here to listen and to ask questions that clarify and to understand why what's being presented is being presented. So again, the comment period ends September 30th. If you do make a comment, the court reporter is here to document what the conversation is, but we hope that you will provide those comments in writing so that they can be captured appropriately. So again, the close of comments will be September 30th. We're here today. We'll do this twice. So this afternoon, we're going to do a shorter version, an abridged version this evening for those that couldn't come this afternoon. But we're going to go through this. Again, my ground rules, you may not agree with what you hear, but all opinions are valued. Please silence any noise-making devices. I will try and keep us on time. The idea is to go through the two panels, and then we will break at 3 o'clock. We'll have a continuation of our conversation, then we'll have to take a dinner break, then we'll do an abridged version this evening, and then follow it up with comments. I think, was there a status report is coming later on this evening. So. With that, I'm going to ask the prosecution team to come up and go over their consensus text that was submitted to the water board. Okay? I think up here is probably...
Hopefully she... I'm loud, so you'll be able to hear me.
Okay. I'll need everyone to identify themselves.
Sure.
Thank you.
Go ahead and
fill out.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you get them?
No, I didn't. You want to try to make it a little bigger? I don't know if that is good.
This is the worst version we want.
Actually, it's the version that's in your packet, and it has all the changes.
Okay. Hello, my name is Ann Holden, and I am the Water Board's a member of the Water Board's prosecution team. I'm a geologist in the Water Board's South Lake Tahoe office, and I'm going to take about 10 minutes or so to go over the consensus changes that were made to the January 15th draft CAO. And by consensus changes, I mean the changes that were jointly developed by the Water Board's prosecution team and PG&E following the May 28th workshop that Gita explained about earlier. So there's a handout here. It's fronted with the pink page that's back there. And what this handout is, it has an explanation of every change that is in the cleanup and abatement order, every consensus change, but I'm only going to cover the ones that are highlighted in yellow. And then those changes, the language I'm going to be discussing is also going to be highlighted in yellow on this screen. And go ahead, Kim.
I was just going to offer that.
I'm sorry, when you speak from the audience, you need to identify yourself every time you speak so that the court reporter can get an accurate reading of who said what.
I'm sorry. This is Kim Niemeyer, and I just wanted to clarify that the consensus language in the draft order is that which is italicized, so that you can tell what that is. So it's in italicized font.
Black italicized font, correct. And the deletions are in black strikeouts, and the additions are in underline.
So I'm going to start with change number 6. Go to the F5. Okay. So this is a consensus change that was made to finding 16, which discussed how, which discussed the background study and how background values were developed. And the change that we made to this finding just described and clarified the peer review criticisms on the 2007 background study. That's the study that we developed the currently adopted background values of 3.1 and 3.2. We added some language to clarify the limitations of the 2007 background study, the peer review criticisms, and then also to acknowledge the ongoing USGS background study that's happening now that may result in new background values in the future for the Water Board to consider. So those are the changes to that finding. Now, on the second page of the handout, change 10, and, okay, so this, we deleted, as you can see in the yellow highlight, we deleted the reference to the term affected area, and we did this throughout the cleanup and abatement order. We also deleted a little further down, finding 43, where the affected area was defined. And we did this because the affected area terminology was a carryover from the 2011 replacement water cleanup and abatement order, and it was no longer needed for this cleanup and abatement order because now there are sampling, domestic well sampling requirements that are set in existing remediation permits, having that mile buffer around the southern chromium plume where PG&E has to sample domestic wells. And then there's now specific requirements for the northern area for domestic well sampling. So the affected area terminology was basically just outdated and no longer needed. So we've struck it throughout the cleanup and abatement order. Okay, moving on to change number 16.
I'm sorry, you said
18.
Okay.
8 when I say 18. Okay. So change number 18, change number 16, we've deleted this finding, this order that was in the original January 2015 cleanup and abatement order, and we basically replaced it with another one. If you can go to page 20. And the key thing we did here is that we defined, we carried over the term that talked about how PG&E needed to continuously operate their remediation systems, and we defined what continuously meant in a footnote, and then we added another order that requires PG&E to submit annual operating plans. And the whole intention of these orders is that we wanted to set a level of effort and expectation for the amount of remediation that PG&E will do, and that will be set in annual operating plans. And then this just clarifies and is more specific about how we judge if there's been reductions in those level of effort and then how PG&E needs to notify us. So we were more clear in these two findings by putting in these requirements. Scroll down a little further on this page. I think there's another. Okay. So now I'm going to discuss change 21, which is on page 3 of your handout. And this is the order that deals with cleanup requirements for the Western Finger area. And so what we did here was we inserted some revised requirements. The key change to note here is that we removed the requirement that they clean up to background levels in the western area by July of 2016. We removed that requirement because we didn't have a technical basis available to support that specific cleanup date. But we went ahead and retained the requirement for PG&E to continue operating their existing remedial actions in the western area. And we inserted in number two, I should have a little pointer. Do you have a little kitty toy? Yeah. Center button?
Yeah.
In number two, we inserted some new triggers so that if we start seeing increases in specific monitoring wells in the western area, that will then trigger PG&E to do to submit a report proposing additional remedial actions in that area. And then if you scroll to the next page. And then this table of monitoring wells was added to set specific monitoring wells that we'll look at for those trigger levels that would require them to propose additional remediation actions. And then this finding here regarding the Western Finger was included just to recognize that there's a USGS background study going on and that there's a preliminary results report that's due from the USGS in 2017 that may have some additional information on the source of chromium in the western area. Following the submittal of that report by the USGS, PG&E has to submit a feasibility study to achieve background levels in the western area. So those are new requirements. And then further down, keep scrolling, we deleted the previous requirements. Again, there's the due date that we had in there that we removed. Page 22. Okay. We're now looking at the section of the orders that had cleanup, that has cleanup deadlines for the Southern Plume Upper Aquifer, and we revise these dates. So this is the requirement for PG&E to reach and maintain the 50 part per billion target. We revised that date from December 2021 and pushed it out 4 years to 2025. Similarly, for the target for PG&E to reach and maintain the 10 part per billion plume, we changed it from 2026 December and pushed that out to 2032. And we did that considering a range of factors, including modeling uncertainty, the range of times that PG&E had estimated for cleanup in their remedial time frame assessment, but also really still wanting to show strong remediation progress. So these numbers represent still the lower end of the range that PG&E had estimated, but not the very lowest number that was originally in the cleanup and cleanup order. Page 23. Okay. This is the section of the cleanup and abatement order that deals with the northern plume cleanup requirements. And we revise these requirements to reflect more current information about monitoring chrome 6 concentrations and monitoring wells up in the northern area. The chrome levels in those northern area monitoring wells have three of them in the original cleanup and abatement order that were defined as hotspots having concentrations higher than 10. This was based on data from 2014 when we were first drafting the CAO that came out in January 2015. So two of the monitoring wells are now below 10, and one of them has had very significant decreases in chromium. So we went ahead and revised the triggers for remediation of those wells based on these decreases that we're seeing. But we, just in case we don't continue to see those decreases, if you can just scroll down a little bit, we've put in, you know, kind of a backstop here. If we start to see increases in monitoring wells or an increasing trend, that will trigger a requirement for PG&E to submit a remediation work plan. So we just tried to update this to reflect more current data, but still leave a backstop if we see things going in the direction we don't want to see. Okay. Page 21. Let's not go back. Go ahead and scroll down. Thank you. Okay. This is the section of the cleanup and abatement order that requires replacement water. As I talked about earlier, we revised, we took the term affected area out of the cleanup and abatement order, and then the change we made here is that we removed the requirement for PG&E to provide an analysis in each quarterly report if there was a domestic well containing chromium within 20% of the MCL. And we took that requirement out because we already had this requirement here saying that they have to analyze whether a domestic well has an increasing trend of chromium. And we decided that that increasing trend requirement was protective, was going to give us plenty of advance warning if a domestic well was creeping up, that it was a better and more protective requirement than the than having that 20% of the MCL. So that really wasn't necessary. So we struck that. And then we changed this language regarding interim replacement water. This is the requirement for PG&E to provide bottled water. We changed that to require it. They have to provide bottled water within 10 days of a lab report identifying an affected well instead of within 2 days of a quarterly report. It's a quicker response time, and so we agreed to that. And then the next change is page 25. This is just throughout the section that talks about the permanent replacement water supply. If you can put it at the beginning of the.
I apologize.
There, right there. Okay. We used the term previously permanent replacement water supply, and we just replaced that throughout this section with the more accurate expression long-term, because PG&E doesn't have to provide water permanently, but just as long as a well is affected as defined in the cleanup and abatement order. So that change was made throughout. And that is all I have. Okay.
So would are there more presentations from this consensus group? Okay. So at this time, are there any clarifying questions or questions up and to clarify any of what you've heard? Yes. Yeah. And if you could identify yourself and speak loudly, please.
Doug Smith, and I think I speak loud enough.
normally,
yeah, thanks. So I have a question, just some clarifying question. On Bates page 1-26, the consensus text that was submitted regarding the USGS background study, when under item 3, I'll wait till Sue gets that up. Page 21, Bates page 1-26.
So, I'm sorry,
1-26.
Oh, 21.
Thank you. Page 21 in the CAO. There you go. So just below that table. So in the yellow highlight says the USGS background study preliminary results report. Are you referring to the report that is due September 2017?
This is Ann Holden. Yes, we are.
Okay. And how is the progress of that USGS study coming along?
It's coming along very well.
There were several deliverables that are ahead of that time. One is on May 31st, due date was to evaluate for the USGS to evaluate existing data. Another due date is December 31st, coming up, to analyze the rock and the alluvium. And third date before that preliminary result is June 30th, 2017, to evaluate the local geologic conditions. How is the USGS coming along on those items?
As far as I know, they're on track and moving forward with all those tasks that are required by the contract.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions from
Anybody in the audience? Okay. Seeing none, I will move on to Lori.
Kevin's going to do it?
Okay. Kevin, you're up.
Hi, I'm Kevin Sullivan with PG&E. And then do we have the slides? The PowerPoint slides. So what I'm here to talk about today is sort of the other half of the consensus changes. Anne spoke about the harder part, which was all the text changes that were proposed for the order itself. I have something called the MRP, that's the Monitoring and Reporting Plan, that I want to give you an overview of. Now, the Monitoring and Reporting Plan is an appendix to the order, and it's the document that describes what is going to be sampled, where, how frequently, and how that whole program is going to work. So it's a place that, honestly, the text is a little dry, but it's very important for the technical people, because it tells us what's important to look at the site, how we're going to do it, and it creates a technical basis for the decisions that we're going to make going forward. Okay. So there was a draft monitoring and reporting plan proposed. There were comments on that during the last public meeting, and we worked on primarily on one major part of it, is what we call the Southern Monitoring Program. So you'll remember that when we talk about the plume and the order, we sort of break the site into two parts. The southern area is also been referred to as sort of the core plume, or the areas where the concentrations are very high, much over the MCL. It goes up from the station up to about Thompson Road. It's, like I said, the southern portion of the plume. The other part, which in this latest version is called the northern or uncertain plume area, that's the area where the concentrations have been much lower. That sort of extends from Thompson Road onto the north. So this is about the southern area. And as part of this process, we had technical folks look at all the data. And this was, we gave a presentation on this, I believe it was two meetings ago, about a lot of the details. And again, it gets very dry, so I'm just going to try to give a high level overview. So, why do we monitor wells? Some of the main things is we clarify the objectives, and the important things with monitoring wells are to track the remediation progress. These are the wells that are going to tell us if we're making progress or not, and if we're on track to get to the ultimate cleanup goals that are specified elsewhere in the order. So that's a very important thing, both for the board to see that PG&E is making good progress, and then also for the PG&E engineers, so that we can see how the plume is reacting and if it's going the way the computer models predict it should. That will also help to track the plume. One of the questions that we've grappled with a lot is concern in the community by others that the plume might grow or expand. This is the monitoring network that is designed to make sure that if that were to happen, that we would see it in an appropriate amount of time, and that we would be able to then come up with the appropriate corrective action. And then, importantly, we know that there are a lot of domestic wells in the area, and this integrated program is designed to make sure that we understand what's happening at domestic wells. So, importantly, in this program, and I've got my numbers written down, I want to make sure I quote them to you properly. There's a set of domestic wells that are going to be sampled that are not going to be talked about much in this, but there'll be 140 domestic wells that are still going to be sampled above and beyond this program that I'm going to talk about. Okay, so there's 140 different individual wells that will be sampled, and that data will be gathered and reported to the board just as it is. So with these objectives, we then looked at the program and said, let's try to update it to meet those objectives. And so the key idea in this program, you'll hear when we talk about remediation, we talk about adaptive management. And the idea that is that we want to be able to get data, look at the data and see what it tells us, and then modify our program as we go along. And so the kind of, in my mind, one of the most important ideas about this program is that we sat down, and if you look in the MRP section, that's attachment 8, you'll see a variety of flow charts. And there's different flow charts for different situations. But in very broad brush, if we see concentrations either going up or going above a threshold, we're going to sample that well more frequently because that's a concern and we want to look at it. And if we see the concentrations either going down or staying flat for a long, long time, we're going to be able to sample that well less because we say we understand what's happening there. And so places that are increasing or that are acting strange or acting unusual, there's a series of triggers in there so that we'll have to sample that more frequently. Whereas if it's either at a very low level or at a very steady, unchanging level, we say we don't have to sample that so frequently. So annually, we're going to look at all the data, and we're going to look at what the appropriate frequency is. Now, there's a big table in the back there where we've gone through all the data that we've gathered to date. And we looked at each well and came to a recommendation that we provided. Water Board technical staff and PG&E consultant technical staff. That was in the consensus language that we submitted to the advisory team, saying this is where we think we ought to start. We think this group of wells should be sampled every quarter, this group ought to be sampled semi-annual, this group ought to be sampled annual. And then from here out, we wrote a roadmap, we wrote a rule book, so that if the data changes, we'll have a guidepost and we'll be able to make changes to those as we go. So it'll take a while for those changes to take effect. You don't change a program just based on one quarter of data or two quarters of data. We look for trends. So a lot of times you'll see that we want to see four numbers in a row that either go up or go down or exhibit a different trend before things change. Some of them require statistical tests over 12 quarters. So there's a fairly elaborate system that's designed, kind of as Ann said, to have a couple of different backstops. If the number goes up dramatically, that could kick it in. If it's gradually rising, that could be a cause for increased monitoring as well. Another important idea is that no monitoring wells are going to be abandoned as part of this order. However, we did write the ability in that if in the future PG&E wants to abandon wells, that we can, in a separate process, we'll propose those wells, make a list, and show why we think it's okay for them to be abandoned. And I'm mentioning this specifically because I think there was a lot of concern and maybe confusion at some of our earlier meetings that somehow this order was going to abandon wells or destroy data or that sort of thing. And that's just not true. There are tensions in keeping wells versus letting go of wells. There are, for protection of aquifers, there are rules on the books that say if you're not using a well, you need to grout it up. You need to fill it up so that contamination can't go down through the well or move within the well. And so at some point in the future, if we see some of these wells are no longer used for monitoring or are not being used for useful data, both by PG&E or by the Water Board or by the USGS, we're taking their input as well because they have some sampling information that they want to have. But if everybody says, nope, we don't think that well's useful anymore, then there'd be a separate process allowed under this order to abandon the wells. But as a result of this order, there's no direction in this order to abandon any wells. And so there again, some of the we also looked at criteria. We decided that it's important if a well was above or below 3.1, the established background level, that might be important for us to decide either to increase the sampling frequency or decrease. Certainly if a well went above the drinking water standard, that would be a concern and that we want to look at that well more closely. And then for things that are in the middle, you know, wells that are between 3 and 10, for example, that might be going up, you know, at 4 and 5 and 6, there's a statistical test that's widely used in the remediation industry called the Mann-Kendall trend test. And it'll tell you, I know it's challenging sometimes for someone who says, well, my well was 4.1 and then it was 4.2 and then it was 4.3 and then it was 4.2 again. Does that mean anything? This statistical test will tell you whether that is significant or not. And so we're using that test as a tool to help us interpret the data and make decisions as to whether we should sample more frequently. So this is just one example out of there's probably about a dozen like this, but I just wanted to pick one so that you could sort of see how a typical well, you know, might behave in this. So right now, let's say that we have a well and it's currently being sampled semi-annually, and it's a pretty low concentration well. It's in the neighborhood of, you know, 3.1 or 10. This is not one of the core wells in remediation. First, we ask the question, is the well been greater than 3.1 parts per billion for the last four events? If it's not, that tells us that, oh, okay, that's not seeming to cause a big concern. It's less than 3.1, so we're not going to change that. We're going to keep that on semi-annual sampling. That's a sort of no-alarm sort of condition. If it is above 3.1, though, then we're going to ask ourselves another question. We're going to say, is it increasing? Because if it's above 3.1 and it's increasing, that could be the beginning of, oh, something could be wrong here. We want to watch it more frequently. So if it is increasing, then we're going to increase that sampling to quarterly. So rather than looking at that well twice a year, now we're going to look at it four times a year. If not, then we're going to say, we'll keep watching it. We're going to just keep looking at it semi-annually. So importantly, no wells ever fall all the way out of the system. Okay, the wells that are in this list, we pretty much, all we're doing is changing the frequency that they look at them. Some of the, you know, some could go up from semi-annual to quarterly, annual to semi-annual. Others could go down. They could go from quarterly to semi-annually. But they'll never entirely fall out of the system under this order. So I think we felt that this was a good balance between frequency, the work, the labor, the time, the effort that it takes to take all this, to report it, to map it, versus not overlooking anything that might change as we proceed forward. So that's the overview of the MRP. As I said, there's a lot of kind of detailed flow charts and a lot of tables. We have our technical teams here if folks have, you know, kind of specific questions if we want to get into the detail, but I thought that it was important to look at this from a kind of an overview level to understand why there's all those words and why the sampling program may not be the same 3 years from now that it is today. I think everybody thinks that that's a good thing because it's based on data. You know, we've always, I think, something that, you know, there was good consensus around is let the science, let the facts kind of dictate our actions here at the center.
Thank you, Kevin. Any members of the public or anybody in the audience that have specific questions, clarifying questions for Kevin? Okay.
Yes. This is Kim Niemeyer. I do want to make sure that everyone understands what the consensus language is and what it isn't. So this language was put together by PG&E and the prosecution team, and it's really helpful for the board and its advisors to understand where there's not controversy between those two parties. But that doesn't mean that the public likes it or wants it to be part of the order. So just because it's consensus language doesn't mean that it automatically will become part of the order. So this is still fair game for anyone to comment on, to offer your suggestions. Just so you understand that when we say consensus, we don't mean done deal. We don't mean that it's automatically in the order. It does show where there's not controversy between those two parties, and that's important because I think they both come from very different viewpoints and have identified ways that they could modify the order, so it makes sense to both of them. It satisfies both of them. But again, feel free to comment on that and to offer other suggestions.
Good point of clarification. Anybody else have any questions? Clarification? Yes.
Jim Griffin from Griffin Dairy Consulting. A quick question, Kevin, on we've heard that you have the triggers on the west side and on the northern side. Are there any triggers in monitoring wells on the west side? On the east side for movement?
Yeah, I think of this, it's Kevin and Sullivan, I think of this as sort of broken into the north and the south, okay? And so that's really the way I think of it. Now, there's a lot of discussion about the western finger as sort of a separate, but I think that there's good requirements for all the wells sort of, you know, in a circle around the plume. So those triggers have been looked at for kind of wells in the entirety around the plume.
Around there, they can be
increased or decreased or what have you. Yep.
Did you want to say something more?
My name is Lori Kemper, and I'm part of the board's prosecution team. Jim, you were just asking about triggers for monitoring, the frequency of monitoring, or were you also referring to some of the triggers related to action? To remediation. You were talking about these specific triggers that Kevin was presenting on monitoring frequency.
Jim Griffin, Dairy Consulting. Using the same logic for the west side and the northern side, is the eastern side got the same monitoring or the same triggers type?
Yes. Yeah, it had on the eastern side of the southern plume. I mean, the same triggers for monitoring frequency would apply, as Kevin mentioned. And we don't have specific triggers in the cleanup order related to remediation because along the eastern side is part of the southern plume where we're asking for those numbers to get down below 50 parts per billion and 10 parts per billion within a certain time frame. Those are the remediation goals.
Clarification on this part right there. You talk about 50 parts per billion. How does that relate back to an MCL?
Well, the 50 parts per billion is really just an interim target. So it's giving them an interim deadline to shoot for.
Is that a 1 or is it a 9 on the MCL?
Well, the 50 parts per billion is the MCL for drinking water practice on Chromium is 10 parts per billion, and the 50 right now is not a standard. It was historically was the California's total. I guess it still exists as a total chromium standard, but in our order, we use 50 parts per billion for the hexavalent chromium concentration, and it's just an interim cleanup target. So we put a date in the order so that we could all measure progress, you know, to be able to say, hey, we've got all the water below 50. That's a milestone.
It doesn't mean much other than
to get all the water.
From the late person saying, well, okay, how does a 50 part per billion number relate back
to the MCL? It's five times greater than the MCL because the MCL is 10.
And I would add that 50 was, we've always talked conceptually of let's get the worst part of the plume done first. And that 50 was a number that was selected to try to reflect that the center, the core of the plume, that there was real, you know, in that area, there's no question about whether or not it's PG&E's responsibility. It is, and we know that that's where most of the chrome is and that we really want to attack that. So that was kind of sort of the background as to why that was targeted and why that was put into the draft language.
Excuse me. Okay. Doug
Smith with the Water Board's advisory team. The monitoring and reporting program had some significant changes in it, in that several things were replaced by some new attachments to the MRP, attachments B and C, which are decision trees, which were based, from what I understand, largely off the IRP manager's suggestions a few months back. Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe the IRP manager had been pretty clear for quite some time about wanting the idea of evolving programs based on data.
So so there's one on attachment B, which is for the southern plume, and then attachment C is for the northern area. Could you explain the differences between those two and maybe work through a couple examples for some of the community members here so they can understand how that would work?
Sure. I can try this, and I'll emphasize that there are brighter minds in the room who put this together than mine, and so I may be looking for help at times. The southern and the northern programs were structured similarly but slightly different based on both the absolute levels and the sort of the nature of the network that was out there. If you think about the southern plume, and these are just, you know, my kind of views of the world, the southern plume, we talked about it before, it had a very strong signal. When you drill a well and you find hundreds of parts per billion of chrome, you know you're it's unambiguous. You're in a plume. You can step out from that. And so there's a very strong picture there of where the center of the plume is and then kind of gradually going out to the edge. So that network was designed with that. And we have literally decades of data down in that portion of the plume. When you go to the north, it's a little bit of a different situation. There's a wide area covered with wells that are fairly new. When I say fairly new, I'm measuring in, you know, 1 to 5 years. That we were still getting our mind around exactly what was going on up there. I would suggest that, you know, as in the latest draft, the advisory team called this the uncertain plumes. I think that's a fair characterization. And so because of the relative level of certainty in the north and south, you'll see differences in the monitoring program. When you're not sure exactly what's going on, you want to have more branches on the tree. You want to anticipate that other things that you might be surprised. And so so in the south, you basically what you see, the south was the example that I showed before. So I'm on figure 8.1. You can see there's a quarterly branch and a semi-annual branch. And the basic idea here is that wells, maybe we can pull up. You don't have attachment eight. Okay.
That wasn't part of your consent.
Okay.
It's part of the board's packet.
It's part of the. So this is part of the board's packet.
So the audience members won't have it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hold on. I have all of item one on here. Just give me a moment, and I can.
Okay.
100. Sorry.
Yeah. So this is the southern one. Why don't we just, you know, kind of look at this and walk through it. So once a year, we're going to look at all the wells in the southern part of the plume. And the wells down there, the underlying recommendation is that, you know, because these wells are kind of in an area that we know has a big, you know, significant plume, we're going to monitor these either semi-annually or quarterly, okay? And the idea here is that this is the logic to say, should we look at it 4 times a year or should we look at it 2 times a year? These wells will never go to, oh, let's just look at them once every 2 years or under this program. So if you're in semi-annual, okay, so we went through and we said, okay, these wells we think we understand, things are not changing that quickly. We're going to propose to initially start them that every 6 months we go out and measure. That's a semi-annual. It's two times a year. Okay? And so then, this is the question that I showed in the other slide. At the end of the year, we say, okay, is the Chrome 6 above 3.1 for the last four quarters? If no, we say, okay, it's below 3.1 for at least some of that. That doesn't seem like a big deal. We're going to keep it at semi-annual. Okay. On the other hand, and I'm going to say this in terms of increasing concern, if it was above 3.1 for four quarters, you go, oh, okay, that's a little bit of a concern. Let's do the next test. You can scroll down a little. Maybe put that. Perfect. Okay. So then we're going to apply that statistical test, the Mann-Kendall trend analysis. So often what we might have is, you know, a well that had 3.5, 4.5, 3.7, 4.2. Well, in the past, folks, before we got good statistical tests, you'd look at that and say, well, I think it went up. Well, I think it went down. You know, you'd have a lot of that. So the Mann-Kendall test sort of gives a recognized statistical method to say, this is an upward trend, this is no trend, or this is a downward trend. And based on that, if there's an increasing trend, we say, hey, that's one that we want to watch more frequently. And so the next year, it would go to the quarterly sampling. If not, if it's just sort of going up and down, then we say, we'll leave it at semi-annual. And so every year, we'll look at that. On the other hand, on the quarterly, it sort of goes the other way. If it's quarterly and it goes below 3.1 and it stays below 3.1 for four quarters, then you start to say, that's not looking like a concern. It's less than the background level. And if it's been below the background level for four quarters in a row, maybe we can decrease that to semi-annual. Okay, because it's a very low concentration. If it's above 3.1, then we do more statistics. And if it's saying it's decreasing, then we can go to semi-annual. Otherwise, it kind of stays where it is. So that's the, you know, this whole thing's just designed so that the data tells us whether we ought to look at a well more frequently or less frequently. So that's the south. And if we could scroll maybe two more pages to the north. Now, the north is a little more complicated because what we have up there is a lot of wells which I would characterize as all exhibiting lower levels of absolute concentration. In general, they're well below 10, but there are a couple that have been exhibited unusual data or surprising data, and we're still a little new up there, so we want to find a way that says if it stays low and doesn't seem to be changing, we don't need to look at it more frequently. But if it starts to look unusual, then we want to start to look at that more frequently. And so some of the wells there are quarterly, some are semi-annual, and some are annual. There's also a layer here that in the south, I would say that we talk about wells that are in a cluster at a well location. Okay. And what that means is that at kind of one point on the map, there might be a well or two or three different wells that are at different levels. And I would suggest that in the south, we understand the plume pretty well in three dimensions. We've been pumping. We see that when we pump from this well, the upper layer is changed, but the lower isn't, or vice versa. Whereas in the north, you know, we went up there sort of exploring, and so we put wells in. Most of them have three wells at one location, and we sort of went exploring because we weren't sure whether we might find chrome in the upper or the middle or the lower. And so the idea is that now that we've watched those for a while, we know which one of those layers is the highest concentration. And so there's some logic built into this that we're going to focus on that highest concentration. Now again, when I say high, it's relative. There might be three wells, and one might be at, say, 3 parts per billion, and the other ones might be at 2 parts per billion and 1 parts per billion. We're saying in that situation, we want to keep the closest eye on that three. So there's some logic that flows through here that kind of pays attention to that. So we'll never ignore any one of the well clusters. But if you just scroll down, you'll see some of the similar kind of logic. You know, it's that same, what's the raw data saying? What's the trend saying? Here's questions about, are there any other wells being sampled quarterly, right? So we're trying to, we put some questions in there that sort of honor where is this data happening in space, because we want to make sure we don't leave any blind spots. And so that's the big difference between the north and the south, but like I said, that kind of logic flow is kind of the same. And if anybody wants to elaborate on that? There was a lot of discussion on this. Yeah.
Penny Harper, Hampton resident. I've got a question on your groups of three wells. You said when you have your monitoring wells in clusters of three, and you said one might have one might have two, and the other might have three parts per billion of chromium 6.
Right.
I thought you drilled them to different depths. Like, each of the three is at a different depth going
yes.
into a different level of the aquifer.
Yes.
So do you find out that they have different levels of chromium 6?
We do.
At the different depths? And going in, do you know how, before you drill, do you know exactly how far down you're going to drill? Or do you test as you drill?
No, good question. One of the challenges that we have is that it's very difficult to test as you drill a well for chrome. It's just, the chemistry is just challenging to do that. So what we did is pretty much in each one of these, we tried to do three. We spread them out. We tried to pick layers that were most likely to, you know, transmit water. And importantly, now we've watched them for anywhere from, I think, around the order of 2 years to 4 years. And I don't know if you were here at the meeting where we showed, we made those big maps that showed all the trend lines that showed for each of the layers how they were. The vast majority of the wells up there have been very steady and very flat. If we got 3 parts per billion one time, we got 2.9 and 3.1. It was just very, very flat. And that was some of what went into, okay, we've watched that for 12 quarters. It hasn't moved. Ones nearby haven't moved. That looks stable. Maybe that's a place that we only sample annually. Okay. On the other hand, there were a couple up there that were really unusual near the fall, and those are ones that John Isbicki's been spending, the USGS is spending some time. Those ones that were changing rapidly, or they weren't, those are sampled more frequently. So that was kind of how we got to this. It was based. It starts out when you first put the well in as an investigation. You know, you're looking for something that you don't know is going to be there, and then as we get more confidence with the data, as we see it for longer, and as it acts in a way that seems expected, then we say, okay, we're going to keep looking, but we're not going to look quite as frequently.
Okay, thank you. Okay, there's another question here. Did you have a question?
Okay.
Yes.
Doug Smith with the Water Board Advisory Team. We've got another question on one of the attachments to the MRP, on attachment A, which is on page 1-88 through, it's a long table,
yes.
Several pages. So on that, there are several columns, and a couple of columns. One is the ATU, the Agricultural Treatment Unit. Another one is the IRZ. Could you explain how the community will know when that information from those wells, which are listed under the ATU monitoring plan, which is not part of this order, and the IRZ monitoring plan, which is not part of this order, how they would know what's what, and when they would get this information, where to view it, because there's a lot of information in lots of different places.
Right. So that's a good question. And
one of the things that I want to point out is that I think one of the big improvements in this order compared to where we are today is that today the requirements for which wells are sampled are scattered through a dozen, something like a dozen different orders. Okay, so there's, because it's evolved over time, you know, there were orders written in response to particular permits or particular questions of the day, and so right now there's about a dozen different permits or plans. And so the goal here was to try to put into one place so you could see the different plans. And you see we basically broke it into remediation effectiveness monitoring. How are the AT, remember the, there's two parts of the remedy, the ag units, the ATUs, and the IRZs. And then do we have the plume under control? That's remediation effectiveness. And then the other part is just protect, you know, going back to the goals, monitoring the chrome to make sure that we understand where the chrome is and that it's not flowing into anybody's well. So what we tried to do here was document the thinking as to why certain wells were doing certain things. So if you'll notice, if you just sort of browse through that table, you'll see. Actually, you want to scroll back?
Yeah. Trying to find the page. Web-based page. Is that on anyone?
188.
Sorry. I don't know where it is.
Oh, yeah.
So it's actually.
Go up a couple pieces?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's
just
up.
Up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's like
70
in the
90s
or
102. Right there. Okay. Go back to that beginning. It's a very long table. So, for example, if you look at, this is I think the second page of it, you'll notice all these wells with the prefix CA, that's not California, that means central area. These are the wells that, when you look at the plume maps, you know, right in the center of the core plume, there's a very, very dense network of wells. Those are the IRZ monitoring wells. Those tell us how well the in-situ treatment is working, and it also tells us about some of the byproducts. But they're right in the center of the plume, largely, if not entirely, on PG&E land, and a pretty good distance away from any domestic well. So you'll see those wells are listed under the IRZ monitoring plan, because it's kind of telling us the main thing we want to do there is see how the IRZs are working. And I'll add as an aside, you'll see most of these are annual or semi-annual because we don't expect to see a lot of, you know, a lot of dramatic changes there. If you, you know, if you just kind of scroll through this, and you can do this at, you know, kind of at your leisure, just scroll down a little bit. You'll see we mentioned the aquifer zone where we know it. That's the upper and lower aquifer. You'll see some of the wells that are used for agricultural monitoring. Some of these wells factor into plume boundary monitoring. In general, you'll see those tend to be more quarterly because we're going to draw the quarterly plume map. So you'll see a lot more Q's on there than A's and SA's. And so that was kind of the logic of what was there. Now, where the actual reports are, to do that right now, I believe you would have to look at the other, the GeoTracker. You could look at GeoTracker.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Oh, yeah, this is Lori Kemper for the record.
Lori Kemper for the prosecution. On date stamp 1-98, and it's the last page of the monitoring, so if you scroll down to the last page of this table, there's footnotes that describe the orders that require that other monitoring. So it says the waste discharge requirements for the ag treatment is order 2014, and the order for hydraulic capture. So that's referenced there. But I think what we're trying to accomplish with this new cleanup order in this table is we know there's monitoring that we're requiring in the cleanup order that is really kind of monitoring the remediation effectiveness as well as just the plume boundaries. But the actual monitoring in the ag treatment order and the IRZ permits, those are subject to change separate from this cleanup order. So we're referring to those orders in here, so, and we have this table so people can see it's being required by those different orders. What we could potentially offer would be to you know, provide links to GeoTracker, or you know, be more clear about the order numbers so that folks would know when those reports are due. You know, but basically you'd have to look at those orders to see when all the monitor reports are due or annual reports are due. Those would be in two different orders.
This is Kevin. The other thing I do, I think from a practical matter, I think this is going to become the dominant order. This is the order that I think is going to be most interest around the overall plume, the overall dynamic. The other orders are very important if you want to understand sort of the details of how the remediation systems are working. I would suggest the technical people in the room who want to follow how well ag is working, how well IRZs are working, what's happening with byproducts in the center of the plume. I think that's more the place of the other orders.
Yeah.
This will be the order, though, that drives what I know from other public meetings has been the thing that's usually been of most interest, and that's the overall plume map. So this order will define that and support that.
Yeah, I think that this order requires an annual cleanup status effectiveness report, and that's going to be really the key place for the public to see how well is PG&E doing. And I also just want to offer to the board and the public that we, I think at one point PG&E did ask for a single monitoring reporting program and a reporting fashion, and because of the details in exact treatment, monitoring requirements, and IRZ, the report would be very large, and the prosecution team felt that it was better to keep these things in separate reports, because having all the monitoring in one place, as much as it sounds like that would be a good place, a good idea, we thought that would be too cumbersome. So we are trying to, we're trying to reduce the number of reports. As Kevin mentioned, there's probably a dozen orders now. PG&E submits various reports. We are reducing the number of overall reports, and yet we are trying to keep the report separate for ag treatment from the IRZ, and then have this kind of more reporting under this cleanup order. Focus more on the actual plume boundaries and the shrinking of the plume boundaries.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yes, Ian.
There's
a court reporter. We need to talk.
Ian Webster, IRP manager for the Inca project. I think to answer Doug's question directly, though, the IRP manager function is one to kind of bridge the gap between the technicalities that are on these slides that you see here and the people living in Tinker. So what we've been doing, what the IRP manager function has been doing today, is taking the complicated information that exists in a lot of the reports and condensing it into understandable, simple terms, graphics, colors, etc. And I think going ahead, the IRP function in the order allows that communication mechanism to occur. So practically, the IRP function will take data and translate it for to be understandable by the lay community person. That means a more direct.
Excuse me, can you keep
the
voice up, please?
So the IRP manager will translate information received from PG&E reports into simple lay terms for community understanding.
Did you get through the accent?
Yes.
We have to translate.
No problem with the accent. Just the ball.
Okay. Are we? Everybody have all their questions answered? Clarification done? Okay. Does anybody need to take a 2-minute break? Are we all good? Okay. I think a 2-hour window is kind of good. So, with that, anything else from the prosecution team? Nope. Thank you, Kim. Or PG&E.
Sorry. Oh, thank you.
Yeah. So, anything else from this group for presentation? Okay. So are we ready to move on then to the next group of presenters, which is the advisory team?
Do we want to take a quick break?
Yeah. I did ask, and I didn't really get any nods. So let's take 5 minutes. We'll reassemble with the other group. Again, the rest.
You know, maybe we should do a 10-minute break,
yeah,
because
it's going to be difficult for the
with the restrooms and everything. So let's take 10 minutes. We'll reconvene at 2:25. We will break around 3 o'clock. Or 3:30.